Thanks for listening to It's All Journalism. I'm Megan Cloherty, here today with fellow producer Michael O'Connell. And here today we have with us Alex Howard, who writes about how shifts in technology are changing government and society. Following the news in the last several weeks, you're likely aware of the events unfolding in Ferguson, Missouri. And Alex is joining us on Skype to talk about some of those issues coming out of Ferguson and the implications they have for journalists.
You recently wrote a piece for Tech Republic on the First Amendment being a check on police militarization. What can you tell us about that story?
I would maybe expand that to being a check upon the use of power by any police force, by any law enforcement officer, by any agent of the government, against peaceable assembly, against the media doing their jobs to document what's happening in public places, in interactions between law enforcement and the people they're sworn to protect and serve. You know, to really highlight the balance that we believe a free press plays in a democratic society, against the unaccountable use of force or the disproportionate use of force against different populations. And this is something that, you know, the United States has struggled with for a long time. In the past week, I've gone back and looked at images and accounts from the marches in Selma and Montgomery during the Civil Rights Act and tried to get more reflections about how press were treated then, because it seems like, you know, here you had a minority population, which in the 60s you know, was still struggling in the South under the vestiges of Jim Crow laws, with the legacies of slavery, looking for equal treatment under the law, fighting against segregation, really standing up for the right to be treated equally. And you had police using tactics from tear gas to fire hoses to dogs to out and out beating, trying to push them off public streets, to make it quite clear that that kind of civil disobedience wouldn't be tolerated. And, you know, as in many cases, the images from those protests really affected public opinion and affected the political context under which our elected leaders in Washington and in Alabama and other places operated within, and I think actually had a real bearing upon everything that followed. And I see the same dynamic happening in Ferguson, Missouri, but also other places. And my sense is always that, you know, our country's Bill of Rights is an extraordinary addition to a constitution that it does create an environment where people have more ability to speak up about their government and the way it is treating them, whether it's state, local, federal, that other countries don't enjoy. And we've seen, you know, the issues that can come out of that when even countries that we think of as being more supportive of press freedom, like the United Kingdom, don't have a First Amendment and what that can mean for them.
The importance of having the law written down, and it was one of the advocates for the Bill of Rights, you know, the importance of having those rights explicitly stated so that people were protected and then say, they could point to something and say, hey, this is my right, this is, I'm protected by law. You know, to sort of go back to a little bit to talk about the civil rights activities of the 60s, I was fortunate when I went to Indiana University that my journalism photography professor was Will Counts, who was a very famous photographer and who had actually taken a very famous picture during one of the civil rights demonstrations of an angry woman yelling at a black protester. And he would tell us about, you know, sort of the fervor in the street and the reaction to the images that came out of that. And I think America really needs, and again, this goes to why the importance of journalism is America needs to have things shown to them. Americans need to have things shown to, need to have things put in their face in order for change to occur. And we saw that in the 1960s. And I think Ferguson is an example of that. You hear something in America's face, and we have to sort of deal with the reality of what's going on in the street. And so our role as journalists is incredibly important. But also, I mean, we have this new technology that's putting a lot of this reporting abilities into people's hands so that they're able to record things and take pictures and put them out there. I mean, that's contributing a lot to what's going on now and a lot of stories that take place.
Yeah, that's right. And it's interesting to watch the police in Ferguson, you know, the local police department, St. Louis, the kind of county police. I know there's National Guard and state police involved. Try to make this distinction between media and the people. And, you know, there's been, I think, justified fear over this idea of, you know, a free press zone. They're trying to put members of the media.
America is a free press zone.
Yeah. Well, you know, but there have been limits. You know, I remember during the First Amendment is not carte blanche. It's often interpreted in different ways and is. I think applied unevenly, but more to the point, you know, certainly here in D.C., we can see how and where restrictions around media and power get applied. You know, I've been in and out of the White House and the Capitol, and can see where media are allowed to be, where they're not, where they're supposed to record, where they're not supposed to record. I remember during the last presidency under George Bush, the idea of protest zones, you know, where they'd put people where they could assemble, but they wouldn't necessarily be, you know, in a place where they might be able to be seen or be heard. The challenge is that the police have a genuine case if they're trying to do crowd control, or if there's a riot, if there's criminality going on, active criminality, then they need to be able to get access, have a clear line of view or even line of fire. You know, so if someone is restricting that movement or their ability to carry out their work, then they can arrest that person, even if it is a member of the media. They make no distinctions at that point. There's no special status given to the press. Yeah. On the other hand, the people have the same First Amendment rights too, and as you noted, the ability for anyone who has a smartphone to take a picture or video and then to share it to the internet, whether it's on YouTube or Vine or Twitter or anything else, effectively puts them in the same spot as a reporter who has the same capacity. The reporter may have training which means that they think about the ethics differently. They may have training, which means they try very hard to put the video image or text in context and try hard to say that it is unconfirmed or otherwise make statements regarding its authenticity or truth. I think that's the principal differentiation, honestly, between so-called citizen reporting, people like to say citizen journalism, and what comes out of people who are journalists, is that they, the latter, are working to fact-check and add context. That's what rises to a level of an act of journalism. But there's no question in my mind that the impact of a networked public means this distinction that police are trying to draw between members of the media and members of the public is archaic. It is a vestige of another time. It does create some real challenges, but as far as controlling information or narrative in a given area, short of bricking everyone's phones or jamming them, they have a very hard time stopping people talking about what's happening, and that in itself is a check upon the police's ability to engage in acts which go beyond that which is reasonable or proportionate. We've had a lot of discussion about the choices that, say, in Ferguson that have been made around rolling in armored vehicles, police that are outfitted shock troops, and most, I think, disturbingly to me, the use of long rifles pointed at people protesting. You know, I was taught in gun control class that you never point a gun at something you don't intend to shoot. And you know, I've seen a lot of images of that, and it to me is a very important thing to capture, because it shows a very different picture than the one that perhaps the police chief or other law enforcement would like to tell us is happening there.
I mean, we're looking definitely at something that's live or something that's going out in the public, which, you know, people can sort of pick up on. It's like, wow, that's something that, you know, is clearly wrong. You know, the police trying to control a message, you know, in real time on the street. But, you know, as journalists, especially journalists here in D.C., we've seen even a more insidious trying to control the message where it's not so much out in the open. You know, you sort of touched on that before when you were talking about protest zones or things that the press doesn't have access to. There was we had a podcast before where we were talking about the AP putting in a protest about not being able to get access to things that were going on in the White House. There's sort of this insidious, I mean, there are lots of different levels to government, police trying to control a message. We're just sort of have the benefit, I guess, of seeing it out in the open and in a very explicit manner.
I'm wondering what led you, I mean, obviously this is all out, as Michael was just saying, you know, everybody's kind of gripped by what's going on in Ferguson, Missouri. And as this whole thing unfolds, was there a certain incident specifically that made you want to write about it? Or was it sort of just the culmination of the event?
Well, you know, it's interesting. The last time I remember feeling as ticked off about something like this it's been years. I think that the issue here is that I've felt like the killing of Michael Brown hadn't been treated like the police department, like it was going to be something that was of national attention. And every move they've made suggested that they never expected to come underneath this much scrutiny, and that the department in question didn't expect to come under this scrutiny, and they frankly seemed like they were being pretty ham-handed about it, and I was upset about that. The you know, systemic discrimination, racial bias, political powerlessness in that community because of voting rights and you know, people being arrested for assault and then losing them. You know, these are things that have been going on for a long time, but unfortunately, because they're kind of the fabric of American life still, it hadn't caught fire. And when media who went in there trying to document how people were upset and why they were upset, were raising up the voices and faces and pain of people who had been living in that environment but not being heard, were targeted, roughed up, or in this case, arrested, I got honestly angry about it. And I write better when I'm passionate. And this felt like an opportunity to say something important in the way I could, because I wasn't there, I wasn't on the ground, about the importance of letting not only the public and media record the public actions of police, but also make it clear that these are, you know, constitutional rights that our government should be protecting. And I continue to be frustrated that despite President Obama saying that the freedom of the press should be protected and Attorney General Holder saying something similar, that there hasn't been from what I can see, a clear enforcement of those kinds of rights coming down to the police, because they're still arresting journalists, the Getty Images photographer, who's taken some of the most iconic images from Ferguson, was arrested.
And I think they're getting mixed messages too. I mean, Speaker Boehner earlier this week said that he supports the detention of journalists if it's getting in the way of the situation. But what, I mean, define getting in the way, you know?
That's right. And I think that, you know, on the... you know, the trouble is that when you allow the officers on the ground to make that decision or that distinction, you're being governed by the decision of men, not laws. know, that's basically allowing officers who are not lawyers, who are not advocates, who are not anyone who is, I think, more empowered to make that decision to be arbiters of what's just and what's not. And I understand that that's effectively what we always look to with for law enforcement officers, that police are an extension of the law, that and that if you have a disagreement with them about how they're enforcing it, the time is not to do it in that place, but to come back using, you know, the legal system itself to question whether someone's civil rights, civil liberties have been impinged upon or violated. You know, the challenge for people living in these communities is that, unlike media, who may have access to either legal resources through their organization or through various organizations that stand up for them, if you're poor and disenfranchised, it is even more difficult to get the same kind of representation and make that case. And I feel like the statement that the speaker made there is in line with a certain degree of support for the police carrying out their lawful duties, but does not line up well for me in the context of how and where we would support journalists reporting from war zones. This is a point I've tried to make elsewhere. I didn't put it into that piece, but you know, we send out war correspondents to Iraq, Syria, Afghanistan with units. They have to be able to keep up, be in physical shape. They have to have their wits about them and move when they need to and shelter when they need to. But, you know, they're moving in actual war zones, actual combat zones where the bullets aren't, you know, rubber encased in steel. The gas may be worse than tear gas or pepper spray. And as we've seen, the consequences for journalists captured can be fatal. You know that, and certainly other countries don't make any distinction between media, and in fact may see them as targets to remove to make sure that their own atrocities aren't being documented. And I feel like that is a slippery slope that I'd like to see our elected leaders be very clear about. That we should be making every effort to protect and embed members of the media with the police so that what happens in their enforcement of the law is documented. And if there's a case to be made that an environment in the United States, in a city in the United States, is more dangerous than a Fallujah or Syria, I'd love to hear it. But it seems to me if we're going to allow journalists to move freely there, then we should do it here. And if our elected leaders are making this case that they should be detained over the course of their jobs and time to document how force is being used, disproportionately or not, then there should be some other way that we use technology to make sure that that's documented. And for instance, if the officers in question all had to wear lapel cameras or GoPros on their helmets, and that, you know, those the recordings couldn't be tampered with, I'd be much more satisfied with saying that the journalists couldn't be in that area, or they had a drone, or the media were allowed to use drones in areas where they said, you know, you can't physically go there, but we respect the people's right to know, and that there should be a recording of this public event. So while we don't want you down the street because we're about to clear it, you are welcome to film from up there, or to use a drone, or to follow right after us. But just understand, if you get in the way of us taking this action, then, you know, we're gonna need to treat you like you're part of the protest. And, you know, then they've been asking people to separate themselves. NPR reporter Elise Hu tweeted last night, I think, something to that exact effect. They're asking the media to separate themselves from the crowds, because the police are having a challenge here that some of the worst acts of criminality, people throwing Molotovs, breaking things, looting, the issues that are basically giving the police more of a need to use more force than they would against, you know, lawful assembly, are often not from in the community. Right. And so there's some really difficult choices and challenges they're making, but or facing rather. But I do think there's every reason to err on the side of caution in terms of letting the journalists take the risks they feel are appropriate to get the documentation of what police are doing in public to the public.
Now, I assume that you've seen the video that the Washington Post reporter Wesley Lowery had posted of his arrest or the events leading up to his arrest at the McDonald's.
Yep.
Yeah. And that's kind of interesting because, you know, I was watching that before we started recording here because there seemed to be no clear danger. I mean, I think we all can understand that if, you know, they're Molotov cocktails, if there are guns or something going on in the street, that if the police officer gives you a lawful order to, you know, hey, move off, that maybe you should think about moving off. But there didn't seem to be any particular danger. It seemed to be more, you know, we need to clear out this area. And I didn't get a real sense from the story that was with it what may have been behind that. But, you know, that can be troubling, especially when you have a police officer telling you to your face, you know, hey, stop recording.
Yep.
You know, I have a right to record.
That's right.
But, you know, and the resolution of that is they arrested Lowery and another reporter and they took him to jail and put him in a holding cell and then they released them. I'm not sure if there's a case that's going to come out of it, but, you know, they took a journalist out of the field. For doing his job.
Yep. I mean, the distinction there seems to be pretty straightforward. You've got journalists in a McDonald's charging and filing. You know, they're not participating out in the protests. They're not blocking the police. You know, hassling them, shoving them, arresting them in that circumstance is for once, I feel like a pretty clear infringement upon the freedom of the press. And, you know, the fact is that I don't think the officers in question have been identified. A lot of them aren't wearing, you know, badges or names, which I think is also something that should be addressed. Anyone who's in these circumstances that is using force, that is entrusted with, you know, the kind of weaponry, the decision making that they are, should always be identified as a, you know, given officer, and I think, as I already said, should have recording on them to protect them against people trying to say they did things they don't, and to protect other people from that as well. You know, there's a story from a couple years ago that came out regarding the treatment of someone who was arrested, who was beaten quite badly, and, you know, eventually was charged for his blood, you know, causing damage to officers' uniforms. you know, they ended up withdrawing the charge after, you know, in court, someone pointed out that if he was bleeding on them, then it certainly implies that he was bleeding for a reason and that he had been beaten, and then they withdrew that charge. And then, but the video itself wasn't available. It had been recorded over that it was at too high of a speed. So there's no record of what actually happened in that cell. And I do feel like there needs to be a bulwark against the use of power. This is something that's not new. The you know, the lack of accountability for people who have power over others is a real and longstanding issue in society. It's one of the reasons that the founding fathers of the United States created checks and balances for its use, and you know, made an effort hundreds of years ago to ensure that the rights of the people to assemble and petition the government for redress of grievances in that use is preserved. And I think that's what we've been seeing in Ferguson, and the you know, from what I can tell, the use of force has been extremely unwise and has inflamed the situation.
This is such a crazy Pandora's box that we can open here. Where, okay, you know, every cop needs to have a GoPro on. We need to be filming everything going on. And then it's like, well, you know, doesn't that infringe upon my privacy? You know, I'm not accused of anything. Why are you filming me? And then people shooting video of something and basically providing something that the police can maybe then use against them. It just seems like, you know, there's so many issues that can just well out of this, you know, public rights and privacy and First Amendment, thanks to this disruptive technology.
Well, my sense is that the police department there has not adjusted. Others have. I had an interesting interaction with the Seattle PD where, you know, I noticed they'd sent out a directive that was getting a letter that was getting a lot of attention where they said that they wanted people to be thoughtful about tweeting what was happening with police. And they responded to me, which is not something that every police department does on Twitter, much less they're not even there all the time. So Seattle PD is ahead. And I basically, in response to what I'd seen, said that people's right to record public actions of police extends to Twitter. And what they try to clarify is that state of Washington's law enforcement agencies are asking for caution during active shooter incidents. So effectively, they're saying if there's an active shooter, they don't want the public to tweet pictures or information about the movements of SWAT teams or other law enforcement agents, operatives, equipment, material that might tip them off to what's happening in a tactical situation, which is common sense, but it does bring you down a slippery slope.
Well, it's something to consider in the abstract, but in the practical, I mean, one would assume that an active shooter may not be checking his Twitter stream.
I don't know if that's true anymore. There was an example, I think, of a fugitive from the law who was holed up in a cabin, and the police, indicated that, he was checking radio and social media. And my sense is that, well, a lot of criminals aren't that bright. Some of them are, and will use modern technology, whether it's a police scanner or looking for, other people in the area sharing information about them. We'll use that to make decisions.
Or they're looking for a reaction, I mean, a lot of times, especially in hostage situations, I know that there's been situations where they're using social media just to see how much attention they're getting.
Yep. And I do think there's a real challenge for us as society to decide how we are going to be responsible with this new power we have to broadcast, to narrowcast, to, to share images and video. For instance, there's been a decision by news organizations not to send, a helicopter over a given area or to put someone on the front page because they don't want to give them notoriety or reward. But I do think there are other reasons that we need to be thoughtful, too. It's something that I've, written about or tried to, think through in years past. I was trained as a first responder, as an EMT in college. So my first instinct when I see someone hurt or see an issue is to think about, airway, breathing, circulation, disability, extremities, give them oxygen, escalate care if you need to. But I do see an awful lot of people, stop to document when someone is hurt.
Right.
The kind of rubbernecking you see on highways has now been, mm-hmm. complemented by people taking pictures. And I always wonder, well, if this was your family member, would you want their worst day to be broadcast to the public? Is there a decision you're making there which is affecting their expectation of privacy because technology has raced ahead? And my sense is that not everyone is thinking about that.
Just content for the Twitter feed is that they're trying to boost up their followers.
Well, I think that's a little hard-hearted, but,
or they're just sharing, something crazy is happening in front of them and they share it, but they're thinking about it from their perspective, not from the victim's perspective.
Yeah, exactly right. And I don't know if people are trying to, pump up their followers through the pain of others, but they might say this thing is happening and oh my gosh. And, to bring it back to this circumstance, it does appear that, somebody was nearby where Michael Brown was shot, took a picture of his body, and then the subsequent police showing up. Is that newsworthy? Is that something in the public interest? I think people might argue now that it might be, that there's a federal investigation, that there's, civil rights attorneys involved. This is a really thorny issue that we're going to be, struggling with the rest of our lives. This isn't going away.
No, and when we think also about just the way police departments are controlling information, just, arrest reports and things like that, that now we have all this other information that's available through social media and other ways, you know, people taking pictures and sharing them. It sort of becomes then the reporter's job to, you know, how am I going to tell this story? I mean, you know, if there's somebody there on the street who's taking a picture of something, do I, you know, reach out to them to incorporate it in the story I'm writing? Or, you know, do I understand what that context of that photo is for my story? Does it inform it? I don't know. There are lots of issues. Let's sort of bring this home and think about what journalists can learn from Ferguson and what we need to be thinking about when we are out there covering something like this. What do you think? Because, you know, one of the things we were talking here was, you know, we reporters going over to Iraq and Afghanistan go through special training so that they can deal with intense situations. I mean, is this something that we're going to need to be doing domestically? Is this something we should have been doing domestically? We just didn't realize it.
You know, I do feel like some of these questions are above my pay grade, or at least above my educational level. You know, I have to always say I'm not a lawyer. Some of these are very much in the wheelhouse of a, you know, First Amendment professor at a law school. I was talking with my wife about this. She specializes in criminal law, and you know, we talk through some of these issues just to, you know, so I can get a sounding board of someone who at least has had that training. You know, I do think the value of these kinds of events is to raise our awareness of deeper issues that are not occupying our headlines. I use the word occupying, but unintentionally. But
yeah,
the fact is that
that's what it is.
the Occupy protests, while they didn't lead to any electoral change, much unlike say the Tea Party, Occupy didn't run candidates. The leaderlessness of that organization is an issue there. But there's no question that the movement, while it lasted, put inequality on front pages. It caused there to be a huge bump in stories talking about inequality, talking about how society had been changing, what was behind it. I don't think it, in the end, stimulated significant legal or, you know, policy or regulatory changes that are, you know, served to directly address it.
But it started a conversation.
But it started the conversation. That's right. And my sense is that what's happening in Ferguson has also started a conversation about race and systemic bias and discrimination that still lingers in large parts of the United States. And I think sometimes we hope that we're living in a post-racial society, but seeing what's happening there, seeing how people are treated, hearing their stories, getting the really bleak statistics about how many black men end up in jail, how they are arrested and convicted at much higher rates for the same kinds of nonviolent drug offenses, the impact that those kinds of arrests have upon their job prospects, may have upon their voting rights, which then goes to questions of representation. These kinds of things really aren't something that leads the local news, and they're very hard to deal with in an effective way, frankly, upon the broadcast evening news or upon cable news, which is not really a bastion of thoughtful discussion these days.
Well, it's because you have to boil it down for TV so much to the point where you're really missing the conversation. You're just spouting out facts.
Yeah, that's right. And so we're not being served by that particularly well, and unfortunately our legislature is more polarized than it has been in living memory, which doesn't bode well for addressing some of these issues. Other aspects of the situation, we've referred to, say, the militarization of police, Well, you know, that's a trend that there have been people documenting. Civil libertarians, American Civil Liberties Union, had a report earlier this year that didn't get a lot of attention. Radley Balco, who recently joined the Washington Post, has written a great book about that. And there, you know, there's some real challenges there in the context of the Pentagon making lots of equipment and material vehicles that were made for use in Iraq and Afghanistan available for, you know, very little money to local law enforcement. And we're seeing the outcome of that on the streets. And the challenge is, I think, that the people who make these things are very powerful interests and would like there to be continued use of them and to have their interests protected to continue to sell them. And unfortunately, some of the, what we can tell from the reporting I've seen, the conditions for them being moved on is they actually get used in, you know, that they don't just sit in a warehouse or garage. And that's profoundly disturbing, I think, to a lot of people, particularly those, frankly, in the military who I've spoken to or seen interviewed, who, because of their experience doing actual peacekeeping, understand that showing up in full body armor and helmets with long guns and armored vehicles is not a particularly peaceful kind of move. That, you know, you're escalating force or the threat of using it beyond which a situation may require, and by doing so you may in fact inflame the situation as opposed to calming it. You know, one of the most hopeful things I saw coming out of Ferguson over the past week was the, you know, state police commander brought in walking in his blue uniform without a hat or armor or anything else with people in a protest. And you know, if you have a lot of people peacefully assembling who simply want their grievances to be heard by government, that seems to be a much more calibrated, thoughtful response than rolling up in full riot gear. Because that it I think simply doing that does escalate the likelihood of it happening.
Mm-hmm. Well, it comes down to community policing versus militarized policing, which
you
immediately put up a barrier there.
And the broader issue of the use of SWAT, special weapons and tactics teams, and so-called no-knock raids or even knock raids where there's a, you know, desultory knock, you know, that's another thing which I think is now getting more attention, particularly the places where, say, in Massachusetts, where they're trying to claim that these organizations aren't subject to normal public records laws, which is, you know, an unacceptable thing if you have people who are breaking into people's property and homes and using lethal force. Those absolutely need to be subject to public records laws, from the actions themselves to, you know, the people involved and how they're spending taxpayer dollars. And I do think there's some evidence that has been, you know, continuing to grow that SWAT teams are not just being used against street gangs or active shooter, you know, sniper, like we saw here in the D.C. area years ago, people taking hostages, those kinds of, you know, movie or television cop show environments, you know, where we imagine SWAT teams are appropriate. They're being used in other contexts, and that should concern us, because this isn't just about, when we talk about militarization, it's not just about how people are dressed, about them having an MRAP, about them having an assault rifle. It's about the actual tactics they use to interact with the communities that they are sworn to protect and serve.
Yeah, what the appropriate response is.
Well, when you're thinking about being in the military, your forces, your allies, and you have enemies. And you know, I'm never fundamentally comfortable with a police force thinking of anyone in the jurisdiction that they're in, thinking of them as enemies. Even if they're criminals, they're still entitled to constitutional rights under the law, even if they've done terrible things. You know, the only place where there's a, you know, the fuzziness is where and when they may use lethal force against another citizen or, you know, against the police officer. And then, you know, the officers have to make very different, difficult decisions about how to handle that. But in general, you know, there's rights of everyone, including media, that they should be looking to protect first, along with public safety. And, you know, once they lose the trust of communities and treat them as others, as criminals, you know, that they treat them as war zones and not their own neighborhoods, there's a problem. And, you know, one of the things that Attorney General Holder wrote in a letter to the people of Ferguson in the local paper yesterday was that the law enforcement forces, the police forces, should reflect the diversity of the communities they serve. And that's something that we've seen also put more attention on here, too. You know, because race still is an issue in our country, having mostly white police forces policing mostly black communities is not a great recipe for the community trusting them. Maybe in 100 years we'll get there, but it's not now.
Yeah. I think when you mentioned the idea of, you know, us being in a post-racial society, I think race is always going to be an issue in America, and I think post-racial is maybe that thing that we should be striving for, and maybe one day we will get there. This has been really a fascinating talk. I mean, there's a lot of things that we touched on about our rights and what journalists should do, and I think certainly at the very least we should use the tools that we have available to us to help protect our rights and the rights of the citizens around us. Thank you, Alex. How can people read your content and see this stuff you've written on this?
Well, I tweet everything I write at Digifile on Twitter. That's the easiest way. But I also put it up on Facebook. So facebook.com/AlexHoward or twitter.com/Digifile, DigiPhile. I'm also on Google Plus and Tumblr and other places. If you want to go right to the outlets, you can find me at Tech Republic, just techrepublic.com and search for Alex Howard. You can find me at E Pluribus Unum, this blog I created focused on open government and technology. Just Google E Pluribus Unum, open government. It should pop up right away. And I contribute to lots of other places too. I'm always happy to connect with the people formerly known as the audience on their own terms.
Well, you are very active on social media. You're on Facebook all day. So,
I dip in and out of it. You know, there's usually a tab with Facebook open, but I wouldn't say I'm on it.
Well, I see you on there a lot. Thanks for coming in. Like I said, this has been really fascinating.
Thanks, Alex. Appreciate
it. Thanks for the invitation.
You've been listening to It's All Journalism, a weekly podcast about the changing state of digital news. Find more info on us and download other episodes at itsalljournalism.com. This podcast is produced in partnership with the Association of Alternative News Media. Thanks for listening.